Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO. It's a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, driving gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 377, and it's proudly brought to you by the always growing TGN supporter crew. We thank you all so much for your continued support, and if you are listening and might want to support the show, you can visit thegreynato.com for more details. My name is James Stacey, and I'm joined as ever by my friend and co-host Jason Heaton. Jason, how are we doing today?
Doing pretty well, coming off a long weekend. You know, as you were reading the intro there, that's so familiar now. I spent a couple days on this long holiday weekend. Christy and I went and did some kayaking and hanging out with some friends that have a cabin a bit further north from here. And inevitably, you know, there's new people in the group that I hadn't met. And they're like, what do you do? And, oh, I co-host a podcast. And then what's it called? What's it about? And then there's just so many questions to answer that I still don't have a good elevator pitch. I just don't have a good reply. I don't know about you. Do you run into that a lot, or it's just
not that often? I mean, one, I'm not an immensely social person. Most people have some idea of what I'm getting into, people I hang out with. But I would say, you know, when it comes up, I usually just say, oh, I host a podcast for people who like watches.
Yeah.
Usually, unless like if that's interesting, the next question will make sense and we can have a conversation about it.
Mm-hmm.
And most people are just kind of like, okay.
Yeah.
And move on.
Yeah, right, right.
You know, it's not that the door is closed, but it's a door with a specific sort of key at that point.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned watches, and some people like draw a blank and then move on, or some people then they've got some great story about I've got my dad's watch. Do you know anything about this? And then lo and behold, it's some interesting old thing. So it can go one of two ways, but yeah, it's
Yeah, for sure. Like they remember the last big celebrity watch story, or their boss has a cool watch, or their grandpa did, or that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's fun. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I don't typically go through the accolades, the TGN sort of pillars with everybody who might be wanting that pitch.
Right.
But yeah, we've got a little bit of housekeeping before we dive into what we've been up to. I want to hear more about your long weekend. I saw some fairly extensive body work that you did in the home garage. We should dig into that for sure. But just wanted to highlight, we have an upcoming event, which will be at Wind Up Chicago the Friday night of that weekend. We will be doing an event with Citizen. We're still working on finding a spot. So far, we haven't had a lot of luck finding a place that can kind of suit our needs. If you're in Chicago and have a spot to recommend that could hold a good number of people and you know, do beer and food and that sort of thing, let us know. thegreynato@gmail.com. Or if you own such a place like that, we'd love to get in touch. But yeah, Jason, with that out of the way, definitely looking forward to being in Chicago in July and seeing you and seeing a few other folks, obviously, and holding that event. Speaking of a good weekend, how was your long weekend?
Yeah, it was good. And but before we move on from the event in Chicago, maybe, you know, I just had a brainwave that maybe we should just host it at the our favorite sushi place. Just shut the place down.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe we do the whole thing at the Museum of Science and Technology in Chicago. We just it'll be like a mass social event, you know, maybe around their large train model or something like that.
Oh, in the submarine, in the U-boat.
In the submarine, for sure. I don't know if we could get a liquor license to serve on that submarine.
Yeah, that's true.
That might be a difficult bit of paperwork.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, we're working on it. If you have any help, let us know. Send us an email. But I'm sure we'll sort it out in the next little while, and we're definitely looking forward to that.
Yeah, you mentioned the body work this weekend. So we did this kayak outing. We strategically chose Saturday into Sunday and then drove home Sunday just to avoid the traffic on both ends of things. And it was nice. We camped in the Defender. We did some kayaking on the Kettle River, which is a kind of a lovely, easy float, a couple hours north of here. And that was great. Although the weather on Sunday was far better than the day we paddled, but that's okay. And then Christy had a bit of a run-in with a snowbank this past winter in her Prius, which has minimal ground clearance, as you might know, and cracked the bumper. And so, I had ordered, this is the beauty of, you know, coming from the Land Rover world where, you know, parts aren't unavailable. I mean, there's plenty of Land Rover parts in the world because there were so many made for so many years. But like to go from that, from ordering from one little supplier in Vermont that imports Land Rover parts to the Toyota network of parts where I could order a bumper cover for a 2014 Prius and pick it up at the dealership for $200 and buy, the matched spray paint. Was just such a revelation. It just brought me such joy to be able to like do this project you know, fairly easily with this ease of finding the parts. And so I had put it off for a while. I bought the paint and I painted it a couple of weeks ago in my garage and did a fair job with, you know, just a rattle can custom color. And finally got around to taking the old cracked bumper off, which just, I mean, I'd love to say that it was difficult and kind of pat myself on the back, but it was a pretty easy job. And I'd done the rear bumper last year. There was a bit of a dent in it that I took the bumper off and pounded it out, you know, the plastic, just to get that dimple out and put that back on. And now I've done the front bumper and I'm starting to feel like I could pretty much disassemble a Prius and put it back together, at least the bodywork, pretty easily. I'm really pleased with how modern cars, you know, for all the lamenting about all the plastic on modern cars, they sure do come apart easily if you have to replace parts. I mean, it's just a bunch of plastic clips and a few screws and a disconnect the wiring from the turn signals and then put it all back together within, I was done within 2 hours, the whole job. So it was great. Very satisfying.
That's awesome. Yeah. I do like the clips are like a double-edged sword for me. Like they're good because they're obviously they can fit quite nicely. They're easily replaced, but also sometimes you get a stuck one.
Yeah.
Or say all of them are stuck.
Yes. And they break.
and you have to basically break or drill them all out.
Yeah.
And I did find, and this took me too long to be fair, but over the course of taking things on and off of the Jeep, the right set of tools for pulling those little clips out makes a big difference.
The spudger
or
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They do, you know, if you get in there with a flathead, you're going to crunch one of them or just snap off the top, especially once they've done 10 cycles of, you know, winter, summer in this part of the world. But I have found that the clips and mostly the way the clips are positioned make more sense on the Toyota. I have a Sienna currently of a similar generation to the Prius than it did on the Chrysler. Perhaps that's not that much of a surprise, but
and you know, I put the new bumper on and then I realized that there were a couple of little apertures that were cutouts on the bumper, the new bumper, that weren't on the old one. And I looked it up and it looked like they were for like
parking sensors, maybe
parking sensors. And then also I think jets for the headlamps.
Oh,
I think, I'm not sure, but so then this morning I was like looking around thinking like, okay, how can I fill those gaps? Well, sure enough, for $16, I can get a set of two blanks that I can pop in there. And I've still got some leftover spray paint. I'm like, it's such a joy, you know, to kind of play around with this thing. So anyway, that was a satisfying. Good. Yeah. It was a kind of a good mixed weekend of some outdoor adventure and some camping and exercise and that sort of thing. And then some productivity and then plenty of downtime to sit on the patio at the end of it and drink a beer and that sort of stuff. So it was great. And you've had kind of two long weekends in a row, right? You had the Victoria Day last weekend and then, U.S. Memorial Day this past weekend.
I did, yeah. I just need to close a window. There's a actually, I don't even need to remove this from the episode. There's somebody blowing leaves near my home.
Oh boy!
One moment. Yeah, I've had a pair of long weekends. The first one here in Canada, I'm on an American schedule for work, so worked through that one. But it was a good time at the cottage, like we talked about last week. And then this week with Memorial Day, I had the day off. So I had a fairly busy weekend. So my father's 75th on Saturday. So we were able to celebrate that and cook a ton of food and had most of my family at my parents' place for the Saturday. That was a really nice day. I had intended to go and get the Jeep, which has been living in my parents' driveway. I was intended to go jump it and then take it to the cottage the next day on Sunday, where it'll live for the summer so we can use it to do cottage stuff, use it more like a tractor for the next little phase of its life. And it wouldn't start. I put the battery on a tender and could just barely get it running on a jump. So either the battery's incredibly low, like there's no, it has a surface charge but can't actually crank, or there's an extended problem from it sitting for the last 6-7 months.
Yeah.
So that'll take that's going to take some more troubleshooting, the first step being a new battery. And then in the end, Sunday was such kind of a crummy day for weather that we didn't end up going to the cottage. We stayed home and kind of got a few things, you know, that late spring, just before summer, tidy up the garage. Sarah went to the garden center and got all the vegetables that she wanted to plant. So the planters are up and running now. And we even picked up a little bit of patio furniture for sitting outside. The previous set we had bought like secondhand from somebody selling an older IKEA set. It looked like wood. And then after, I think maybe one winter, it all just kind of disintegrated like fully. It was wood of some sort. It just apparently not the type that you could even conceive of leaving outside. So we got a simple metal table. And then Monday was really beautiful weather, so it was nice to kind of kick back. We finished on a previous episode. I talked about The Pitt,
yeah,
the TV show. We finished the second season of that. I don't dislike it enough to say like I want to rescind my final note.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure it would have made the final note if I'd watched all two seasons.
Oh.
The second season felt very not disjointed, but like it couldn't decide which point it was trying to make.
Huh. Yeah.
Yeah, we're recording this Tuesday morning as we normally do. I head to New York for a couple of days in the city this afternoon. So finally shooting the main elements, the main two camera elements for this Tudor project I've been working on for several months. It's tough to record some footage before Watches and Wonders. And if you don't get it out before Watches and Wonders, there's going to be a huge delay. So we've got it down to three pretty solid episodes. And I'm looking forward to having those go live in June, but I'm going to shoot those in person properly down in New York City tomorrow. And then Thursday we have the Hodinkee Happy Hour Hangout, which is going to be great. And otherwise just a few meetings and that sort of thing. It's nice to get down there. And then I'm jetting back Friday with the hopes of it being great weather, and we'll be at the cottage for the weekend. So
nice.
That's the travel schedule for the next few days. It's been pretty good. It's been nice to have some warm weather to be outside, to feel too hot.
Yeah, yeah.
I was we had a lilac bush fall over in our front yard from a storm the other day.
Oh wow!
And I drove a spike into the ground and then like ratchet strapped it back up.
Hmm.
And I didn't realize I don't own a sledgehammer, or if I do, it's at my cottage. And even that one I might have borrowed and just not given back from an uncle. So I was trying to get this big spike in the ground that I'd made from a piece of wood in my garage, and I ended up using a kettlebell.
Oh, nice.
Like a 40-pound kettlebell.
Yeah.
And after three or four hits, it was like warm and muggy. I was like, man, it feels really good to be kind of overheating.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Just based on like the environment, it feels like I had just been cold for so long. Yeah. My blood felt better this weekend, so I enjoyed that as well. And the lilac bush is standing, so we'll see how long that lasts.
Yeah, it's downright hot here the past couple of days, and this week looks up there around 90 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's instant summer compared to Saturday when I was wearing,
yep,
you know, a sweater and a stocking cap in the evening. So feels good.
Well, with that out of the way, you want to get into some watches. We've talked about a bunch of other stuff. Automotive repair is definitely, yeah, right, listed in our, you know, the superlatives and, yeah, and that sort, yeah, of thing. But yeah, you want to get into some wrist check?
Sure. Yeah. I pulled out, I sort of along the lines of our today's theme or main topic. I pulled out a watch I haven't worn in quite some time, and it's my Royal Navy Diver from 1995. This is the CWC, which issued in 95. It's got the Circle T tritium dial. I did have the movement actually replaced and the seals all redone about a year ago, and really haven't worn it since. You know, we had the CWN1 come out, and that kind of took over my wrist for a while, at least when it comes to this form factor, kind of a CWC-shaped watch. But I saw this in my watch box when I was doing my purge a couple of weeks ago, and kind of had a soft spot. So I pulled it out and threw it on a gray NATO, of course, and yeah, I've been wearing it for several days now. It's just, I don't know. I'm, you know, the CWN1, the titanium, et cetera, the 12 hour bezel, I love that watch, of course, but there is something about these old steel, CWCs that I just have such a soft spot for. They're just so great.
Yeah. It's funny that one made your list because, and I texted you about it the other day. The 1983 reissue that you gave me,
yeah,
wasn't running. And I was like, oh, maybe I'll sell it. And so I fitted a new battery,
yeah,
and, you know, made sure it was running okay. And in the process, I was like, I'll put it on a strap and throw it on. And I put that, you know, it has that tan sort of luminous treatment.
Yeah.
And so I put it on like a tan NATO. And I don't think there's, for the few hundreds of dollars that I'd get in selling it, I'd rather hang on to it. It's a great one for my,
yeah,
you know, to give to a sibling at some point or to loan out to people who might want to experience the brand.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, the bezel's awesome. It's a polished case, which gives it a whole different feel than the CWN1.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in many ways, that's, you know, between that and the CWN1, that's my only real guard against buying a sword hand Seamaster.
Right.
Yeah. The Titanium or the 2254 or something like that. So I got to hang on to that just in case. I don't want my defenses to get too low and I end up buying yet another Titanium, dive watch with sword hands. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. But those are great watches. I still think like even at the list price, they offer great value, but they're also well enough made that they make a really appealing sort of second hand option.
Yeah.
Especially I think in automatic, of course, you and I'm rocking a quartz one, which I'm fine with. I actually really kind of like the idea that you set it and then it's could be your weekend watch, could be your jumping off the dock watch, that sort of thing. The lume's great, the bezel's awesome. Yeah. They're solid pieces for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, just that spec, like not just CWCs, but like that spec that informed those sorts of watches, whether it was a 5517 all the way up to a CWC or, the Omega Seamasters. I think it really has led to some really fantastic watches in the last, 40 years.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, there's the sword hand remains my favorite handset configuration. Although you could argue that the watch you're wearing today has a equally iconic and appealing handset.
Yeah. I think when we're talking about my Pelagos 39, I've been wearing it quite a bit the last week as I rewrote all these scripts, several, pages and pages of scripts for these videos we're working on.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of telling the story of how that watch was made,
mm-hmm.
Which I'm excited about. And with the 39, I really like the Snowflake hour hand, but I see constant feedback. Anytime you write about a Tudor that has such a hand or you put it on Instagram, somebody will be like, great watch, don't like the hour hand.
Huh, interesting.
And yeah. I think there's a strength in that. Some design elements can be divisive enough to feel characterful, yeah. Which I think this does.
Yeah.
But I understand it's definitely less conventional than a sword hand. And as a guy who really doesn't like the skeleton hands, mm-hmm. on, the 95 post, the majority of those Seamasters, I totally get how a hand, if it doesn't hit you right, kind of makes the watch not something for you.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
So I understand that. But yeah, I'm wearing my progressively more and more worn and proper looking Pelagos 39. So on the bracelet. It's just right. I love it for travel. I'm not changing time zones, so that's not a big concern.
Yeah.
And I have, and we'll get to this when the videos finally come out. I already loved this watch, so it's like very much preaching to the choir, but being able to see the case be made, elements of the bracelet be made, all these elements, seeing them assembled by somebody by hand, it just brought me a different level of respect for watches. It's a very expensive watch. It should be made very well. But I just always assumed, and I think I've said this on past episodes where I alluded to these eventual videos, but I always assumed that most of the industrial process behind a Tudor was a machine.
Yeah.
And like they're using the machines where they make the most impact, but in scenarios where they still need hand eye, mm-hmm. they still have it. And I think that's the thing that kind of surprised me the most. And it definitely kind of rewarmed my appreciation of the watch. It was a watch that I wore all the time and it kind of become my default.
Yeah.
But it like upped my overall like emotional impact to the watch for sure.
Well, I'm glad you haven't completely gone over to the dark side of analog digital watches after your recent flurry.
No, I would say I'm largely split. I mean, I'm wearing the Aerospace a ton. It's that friggin' polymesh bracelet is so good.
Oh, yeah.
It's so much fun and it just weighs nothing and it wears really well. But definitely, I'm not sure I would have worn, I guess I was wearing the CWN1. When I was slamming the spike into the ground with the kettlebell.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I would do that with my Aerospace.
Oh.
They just don't have a reputation for being super robust. And I am prepared for this one to break at some point and it will have to go out to Breitling. That's the life of that experience.
Mm-hmm.
I would lean on the Pelagos or the CWN1 for that kind of work for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
All right.
Well, look, speaking of watches we wear a lot and in some cases less, you want to jump into the main topic, which is where did you get the inspiration for this? You said it came from one of our meetup or one of the TGN Slack groups.
Yeah, I was intrigued by this idea. And I apologize to the organizers of this meeting and the attendees because I looked through Slack extensively last night and today trying to figure out which kind of local or regional meetup group inspired this. But the topic here is the watch we wear the least. And it was a kind of a theme for some meetups that a group of our TGN crew were having in one city. And if this is your if this is your brainchild or your thing, do let us know in the Slack and we'll give you full credit here. But I just love the idea that these guys would show up wearing the watch from their watch box that they wear the least. I think it's such a fun theme, because you kind of tend to see the same, you know, the usual suspects when you go to a watch meetup. It's kind of what's popular those days, what's being talked about. And so for someone to pull out, it's kind of an oddball out of their collection that they don't sell and they hold on to for whatever reason, and then wear it to a meetup's a great idea. And I thought we could kind of turn that into an episode where we each talk about a watch, or, you know, a few watches or just candidates, and then maybe the watch we do wear the least, but we probably will never sell or would be at the bottom of the list. I thought it'd be kind of a fun thing to do. So that's where we are.
Absolutely. So I definitely have too many watches. So there's a lot of watches that I don't wear a ton. Yeah. But when I look at the box, some of them have a specific connection to a person, or they were a gift from a family member. Like, there's watches that I don't think count regardless of how much I do or don't wear them. If they have like a family background, an heirloom quality, or a lot of sentimental value. Would you agree on that front?
Yeah, definitely. I think I'm in the same boat. And so to a certain degree, I guess the criteria for this might not be the watch, truly the watch we wear the least. Cause you know, I've got my grandfather's hand wound Timex. That's just, it's just not me. It's tiny. It's kind of whatever. It's just not a great daily piece. And it's not my taste.
And like the benefit of wearing a watch like that, I have that, you know, the Bulova that I had, Roldorf Restore.
Yeah.
That is, you know, of the lineage of my grandfather, great grandfather. And, the benefit of wearing that watch, like on, like, you know, I might wear it to a family wedding or something like that for mm-hmm. a few hours.
Yeah.
Beyond that, if you break it, like what did, I don't know, like it's, I'm so not like a treat your stuff like a museum.
Yeah.
Except when you get to these certain watches.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where you go like, that's nah, that one's in good shape. Let's keep it that way so it can be passed along. Like I feel I'm more of a steward of that watch than a user.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
I kept my pick to watches that I use mm-hmm. or would be classes watches should just use and enjoy.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. For instance, I've got an Accutron Space View that someone from our crew kindly sent to me a couple of years ago.
Like a vintage one?
It is, yeah. It's from the late 60s. It's a space
view. Oh, those are so cool.
It is very cool. It's got the gold case, and I've got it on a blue. Do you remember what they called it, but the strap, the nylon pull-through strap that the wind-up shop was selling for a while there. I think they still sell it, because I bought it because it was narrow enough, and it's kind of this nice blue, and it just goes well with that. And Christy wears this watch more than I do, but I haven't worn it much, but every time she wears it or every time I pull it out and look at it and listen to that hum, it's just a beautiful, cool watch, but it's tiny and it just doesn't look great on my wrist, but it's just one of those pieces that's just fun to have and to look at. And I think we both have a few of those. I mean, you've got some vintage stuff and your chronograph suites mm-hmm. and stuff like that, that, you know, you probably wear a couple times a year at best, but then they tend to sit. But I like your distinction that, you know, these are watches that we would use and that are kind of in our wheelhouse, but that we just don't wear very much. So,
yeah. And when it comes to something, oh, and I did want to say, I searched back through the meetups channel, least worn watch was a watch hang event. So that's Oliver and his crew in Vancouver.
Ah, okay.
Big shout out to those guys. That's rad. It looked like a really well attended event. If you search least worn watch in the Slack, you will find their coverage of the event. It looked like a great time, but I did want to, I was like, oh, I think we can maybe find this. Slack will keep us at least probably 60 days.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Going back. Oh, so I dug around and yeah, shout out Oliver for a great idea. And Oliver has a very broad taste in watches, so it wouldn't surprise me if he has some that he enjoys, but maybe doesn't wear that often. So I like the impetus. It's a good one.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, when it comes to, and I'll get to my pick in a moment, but when it comes to something like the Chronograph Swiss, mm-hmm. which is a little outside my normal, I really like that watch, but in very specific settings. Mm-hmm. And what I found is there's another way that I can enjoy a watch like that, which is to loan it to somebody who hasn't had the experience.
Oh, sure.
Because it's not a super expensive watch. Arguably, most of the value of the watch is because I got it from James Lambden.
Yeah.
And I really like James. And when I put it on, I kind of think of James, and that makes me happy. I think it's a pretty watch. It's not an overly fancy or expensive watch, but it runs nicely. It's a cool thing to have. And currently it's on loan to Tim Jeffries.
Oh, nice.
My colleague at Hodinkee, he wears a suit most of the time. I think if it's under 95 Fahrenheit, he's in a suit. And I thought, if there's a guy who should probably check this out, it's Tim.
Yeah.
And so he's had it for a little while. And look, he maybe wears it around New York. Maybe gets all fogged up. We'll sort it out. It's okay. Mm-hmm. I'm not precious about the stuff that I'm precious about. I wouldn't wear everything else. Sometimes you just go, hey, I'm not wearing this. And maybe that's what will happen to the 1983.
Yeah.
It's a nice legible watch. Maybe it goes to my dad for a bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or goes to one of my brothers to kind of experience something else.
Yeah.
And so I think that's also an option. But weirdly, the one that immediately leapt to mind is a watch I really like, that I have no interest in selling, that I don't really want to loan to anybody, mm-hmm. but I also don't really feel like wearing it much more than probably once or twice a year. And that's my Seiko Orange Monster.
Yeah, I was surprised by this pick. For some reason, I thought you wore it more than you did. Because, I mean, you've talked so fondly about the Monster,
yep.
Mainly with a hint of nostalgia. I mean, I think, yep. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like your love of this watch kind of brings back kind of the early days and kind of that warm feeling you get, that when you remember your first days of collecting and getting into watches, right?
No, I think you're definitely right. For me, the way, I tried to think of a analogy for the way that I think about the Orange Monster, because I still really enjoy it. I like it. I like seeing it in my watch box. I like knowing that, my first automatic Seiko was a Black Monster.
Yeah.
Right. And then when the opportunity came up to get another one at a good price through, a little group connection, I was able to get another one. And then I was able to trade Chris Soule for the orange one. So this one does have a sentimental underpinning to it.
Mm-hmm.
That said, it's not like, I don't think Chris Soule would disown me if I flipped it or sold it off.
Yeah.
But for me, it's a little bit like if you go through your music collection and there's some albums in there that you don't listen to anymore. Or at least you don't, they're not like part of a playlist you've been rocking for the last few years. Like for me, if I go back through my old iTunes, I'm mostly on Tidal now, but if I went back through my old iTunes, folder,
yeah.
You'd find like Sum 41 and MXPX and maybe some Blink 182 and that sort of stuff. And like, I don't listen to that often now, but I also, deleting it would be nuts. You know what I mean?
Like
I was, it's more just that it would feel like I was betraying where I started to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And I like having that footnote because there's a bunch of watches that I sold back in the day when $200-$300 meant I could get another watch to learn about.
Mm-hmm.
And that would include my Black Monster, which probably lost out to my SKX 007, which is now on my dad's wrist.
Oh, right? Sure. Yeah.
And he wears it all the time.
Yeah.
I saw it. That's what he was wearing this weekend. Huh. On a tan NATO, the one with the 12-hour bezel.
Oh, nice.
It's great.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
But I don't still have my Orient Red Beast. I don't have my first Citizen NY0040.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bunch of watches that I had back in the day. I had a Yema Sea Spider. It's like 39 millimeters with a really cool dial.
Wow.
And I sold that one. I remember I bought it for like two. It was the only time I ever like made money on a watch. I bought it for $200-$300 on Poor Man's Watch Forum, and then somebody saw a photo of it on Watch You Seek and sent me a DM and offered like $800 for it.
Yeah.
US. And I was like, this is nuts. I gotta do it.
Right.
And I kind of wish I had kept it.
Yeah.
And I don't want to put myself there with the Monster. Like for me, the Monster's kind of like, it's like if you, again, here's another analogy. If the music one didn't land for you, if you really don't like, semi-Canadian or North American pop punk, it's like when you have a house and you see like that one brick that has a little signature in it,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
or like a little, or the sidewalk that has the handprint of a family member in it or something like that. Or you go down, I remember the first house I bought when we redid the basement, there was like people had signed one of the rafters,
mm-hmm.
like probably the original owners. And like, for me, that's kind of when I open my watch box, I need to see a humble, cool, characterful, really fun, not too serious Seiko in there.
Yeah. Or to hone the analogy of the house, the height markings, like when a kid, you stand in the doorway
and they
like mark your growth. this almost feels like your growth in the watch hobby, like I start, if you look down low here, there's a Seiko Orange Monster hash on the door frame here. So it's kind of like,
I think you got to have it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's how I see it. I still really like the watch, and I would say I wear it. I find it quite heavy, especially on the bracelet, and I find that the Monster doesn't appeal to me as much off the bracelet.
Yeah.
Although I have been flirting with buying like a higher quality expression of their rubber strap.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe Zulu Diver makes one, or Uncle Seiko, probably both. And then wearing it this summer, because the loom's amazing and all that kind of stuff. But really, it is a I don't need another analogy. It's one of the two that we've made already.
Yeah.
But I still really like the watch. I just feel no impetus to wear it or get rid of it.
Mm, yeah, yeah. So besides it being heavy, like why do you think you don't wear it more often? I mean, is it a style thing? Is it just like your personal style has moved on?
No, I don't think so. I still like the way they look. I like when I see them. I love those Gen 1s especially. I think it literally is kind of the wearing experience. I'm so used to the titanium stuff, even titanium on a bracelet.
Yeah, yeah.
Is kind of the home plate currently, that it feels wild to, it's so heavy.
Yeah.
With the steel bracelet as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't have a thing I don't like about it. I guess I'm in a mode of liking listening to other stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a good segue for mine, because you know, when you talk about a heavy watch and kind of the wearability of something.
Oh yeah.
So my pick is, you know, I've got a couple of old Seiko divers kind of in the SKX mode, 7002, you know, et cetera, from the 80s and 90s that I just don't wear anymore. But the one that I picked to discuss here is my Bremont, my Supermarine 2000, which is a watch that, if you remember, I used to wear a lot. I mean, that there was a time when that was like my one watch pick. I loved that watch. And it came with some kind of sentimental value to it, kind of a special meaning, because it's actually the on the back, it's hand engraved S3. It's like the sample 3 or prototype 3 watch. It was like literally the third made. I think the first one was like Nick English's and the second was Mike Pearson's. And I got number 3. And the reason I did is because at the time, Gashani and I were vacationing in the Bahamas, and we happened to be on a dive trip, and Bremont had a launch event for that watch, for the S2000, in Grand Cayman the same week, and they wanted some underwater photos and video to show at their event, and so they sent me this watch and said, if at all possible, could you take some photos on your trip and email them to us, and we'll show them at the, wherever they were, some jeweler in Grand Cayman. And so we did that, and I sent the photos and video over to them, and they used that stuff. And then they said, you know, please, you know, as our thanks, you know, keep the watch and whatever. And I wore that thing on the rubber strap, excellent rubber strap, you know, great watch, but you know, this is a 45 millimeter steel watch, with 2000 meters of water resistance. So you can imagine it's thick. It's got a thick crystal. It is so heavy. And then for whatever reason, years later, I bought the bracelet that went with it, because I thought it looked good, and it does look good.
Yeah, I remember when you got it.
But the bracelet on that watch, and that's how I've got it currently, part of the reason I don't wear it, it is so heavy. I should weigh that thing. It is so huge and heavy, and I've just moved on. I used to be such a proponent of big, heavy dive watches, thinking that's how they all should be. And it's part of the reason I'm you know, I keep flirting around with getting a Panerai, but every time I see photos of the ones that I like, I'm like, would I really wear that if I owned it? Because they're just big and heavy, even, you know, even like a 42 millimeter steel Luminor or something is going to be a lot of watch on the wrist. And so I just don't wear this Bremont at all. And then I think, you know, as we've discussed quite a bit over the past couple of years, you know, with the changing of the hands of the company and kind of the new direction they've taken, I've just kind of lost my attachment to the brand. They're just,
for sure,
they're not what they used to be. You know, there was this personal connection with Nick and Giles, and when Mike Pearson worked there, and we did some special stuff with them, you know, even on TGN, you know, at their townhouse event in London. You know, we recorded there. I mean, we've just had some fun with their ambassadors, and the watches were great. We both were such fanboys of Bremont, and the old stuff is still so good. And this watch is really an excellent watch, but I for a number of reasons, I just don't wear it. And yet, because of its sentimental value to me, it's one that would be one of the last to go in my collection. And so it sits, it's tucked. I actually took it out of my watch roll because it was kind of weighing down one end of it. So I put it in one of those kind of zipper Oakley style vault, clamshell cases, and it just kind of lives in that in the bottom of my watch box. But
yeah,
that's the one. It's a pretty watch, but man, it's tough to wear.
Yeah, I mean, I for me, my last Bremont was the S302,
yeah,
which I absolutely adored and really liked. And then for a litany of reasons, many of which we've talked about in the past, some of which you just covered there, I kind of lost my affinity for the brand behind it. It felt like it wasn't the same scenario that brought me to the watch, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And maybe that sort of highlights something with the Seiko Monster, where I don't think that has changed for me.
Mm-hmm.
If I wasn't doing this at a professional level, I'd probably have a Seiko or two, and that's what I would wear, or a couple of Citizens, or an Aqualand and a Slim Willard, or something like that. And then that, you know, I'd be covered, right?
Yeah.
I still think that they make a great watch. I don't really think that they've largely, you know, the price point has moved up, but find me anything in your life that hasn't at this point, in the last 20 years, right? Things get more expensive. I still think Seiko offers a lot, and certainly the criticisms you could level at the Orange Monsters movement have been progressively addressed with further generations of Seiko's movement development. The scope of Seiko hasn't changed that much in my mind over the years that I've been doing this and have been interested in the brand. I've been fortunate enough to make a living in this world, and there's a certain laddering effect of you're just kind of always spending more, or at least you feel like you might, to get the next experience, you might have to spend more. So whereas, you know, maybe I've gone from the occasional Seiko to the occasional Tudor, that doesn't mean that I feel that much differently about the Seiko, but certainly it in some cases that's what went on with the Bremont, the S302 I had, which is, it remains an absolutely fantastic watch.
Yeah. What other candidates? I mean, do you have any others in your collection that you when you were weighing the choice for this episode, or was that just a clear pick?
I think that's probably the clear front runner. Let me take a quick look at the box here in case.
Yeah, for me, I've got several Doxas that I don't wear. I mean, I actually have the full trio of the Black Lung collection from the Sub 300, and you know, I just, for whatever reason, I just don't wear those watches as much. The one Doxa that I do wear on occasion is the vintage one that I have, which is the 69 or 70 Shark Hunter T-Graph. I just feel like I've got the attachment to that. And for some reason, when faced with a handful of Doxas, like the vintage one just leaps out. I mean, it's the one I always want to pick up if I want kind of a Doxa experience. So
for sure. Yeah. You know, just taking a peek at the watch box in case I glossed over something, you know, I've got an older Halios Tropic.
Mm-hmm.
That I like but don't wear that often. If I was going to throw a Halios on, I really have a very strong connection to the Vancouver LE C4th that they did with Roldorf, of which I have one of those, and then the current titanium C4th on the bracelet. Again, titanium has become the uniform in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't get a ton of wear of the Tropic, but when I throw it on, I really enjoy it. It doesn't really wear like anything else, has a lot of character. The case is quite interesting still all these years later. And then as far as Doxa goes, man, I sold my 200T because it was losing out to my 300, 50th anniversary Sea Rambler. I love it. I wore it the other day. I'm going to wear a ton this summer. If I have one complaint about that watch, is that the lume isn't that bright.
Mm.
So it makes it a slightly less appealing watch for the cottage, where it's nice to wake up in the middle of the night in, you know, a very old farmhouse that doesn't have a lot of power.
Yeah.
And just be able to glance over and see what time it is. You know, the Vertex is nuts for that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But it's definitely still part of the rotation, and I don't even think I've lost 1-2% of my love for the 50th anniversary Doxa. I just think it's a fantastic watch.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, well, a giant Bremont that represents an older era, and certainly the Seiko Orange Monster, which kind of represents my start. Like I said, no real interest in getting rid of mine. Would you plan to one day move the Bremont on, or it's with you for good?
I wouldn't say for good, but I'll still hang on to it for a while, and I'm tempted, you know, as we're talking, I'm like, maybe I should pull it out and put it on today. But I know what'll happen, because it happens every time I would do that with this watch, is I'd put it on, and a couple of hours in, I'd feel it on my wrist, and I would switch it out for something else.
Yeah, maybe on the rubber.
I think on the rubber is kind of the way it came, and that was
that's
the way it was available before they even released the bracelet version. And so I think it looks best on that rubber. It was such an excellent rubber strap. So yeah, maybe I'll give it some wear. It is such a fantastic watch.
It is. I mean, the S500 was my kind of introduction to Braimon. I still look back on it very fondly. Maybe once every few years, I get kind of randomly served an image that I shot of that watch back in the day for Watch Report. And I still think a great looking, very distinctive, didn't look like everybody else's dive watch at the time or now. And I think you see that in the 2000 as well. You know, the one thing that I think we could kind of do to put a bow on this part of it is I'm open to the fact that since I had my Black Monster and even got the Orange Monster, there might be a strap that suits this watch so nicely that I just don't know about. Maybe it's one of these Uncle Seikos or otherwise. Let me know in Slack. I will buy a strap for it and I will wear it this summer, sort of revisiting a classic. Maybe it's a cool story. Maybe it's just something we talk about to follow up on this episode. I'd be more than happy to wear the watch, but I think my time with it on the bracelet is very much an aesthetic choice and not an ergonomic one. I would prefer. So I am open to a strap suggestion. And if you're in the chat and you have an idea for a strap that might help balance out the S2000, let us know. And we can try them out for a while and follow up this episode with wearing the watch we wear least.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I love that idea too.
Maybe we're just a strap change away, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Think about our experience with the Aqualand.
Mm-hmm.
I think that rubber strap that it comes with makes a lot of sense if you're putting it over a wetsuit.
Yeah.
It makes less sense if you have a 7-inch wrist like me and kind of bony, and it's a lot of strap even for a big watch.
Yeah.
But then you put it on that Woche strap from Amazon or a NATO, and I think it wears quite nicely.
Yeah.
And it really makes the watch very comfortable and easy to wear. And maybe there's a solution for R2 watches that get them back on a wrist, get them back in rotation.
Yeah.
Because I would be happy to wear the Seiko more than a couple times a year if I had what felt like a real nice kind of grab and go, not too heavy, easy to wear sort of solution for the mount.
Yeah. And thanks again to, I guess it was Oliver and the gang in Vancouver, right, for this idea, for this episode. You know, they didn't contact us and we didn't contact them. I just kind of remembered it from seeing it in the meetups channel on Slack and thought it was kind of a neat idea. And I enjoyed this. I thought it was kind of a different take than we usually have on the show, which is we tend to talk about watches we love and wear a lot. And not that we don't love these watches, but it's just kind of a fun spin.
All right. Yeah. Thanks very much, Oliver. And shout out to the Watch Hang crew. Hope to cross paths with all of you soon. How about some final notes?
Yeah, sure. I've actually got two, and one is a book that I just finished, which is from one of our favorite authors that we've talked about in the past, and that is Patrick Radden Keefe. I just finished his most recent book, which just came out, I don't know, a month or 6 weeks ago, called London Falling. And it's again, true story. You know, he's an incredible investigative writer. And this book was spawned by, from a New Yorker article that he wrote a while ago, also a long New Yorker article. And I've listened to some interviews with him lately. And you know, the interviewer's like, your New Yorker article was quite long. How did that turn into a book? And when you read this book, and in this case, I listened to the audiobook with him narrating it, you can tell why. I mean, he gets into such detail and such, I would call them tangents, because you're listening, you're like, how does this relate to the actual story, the main storyline? But it's fascinating. You don't mind. You just listen along or read along, and it's great. But anyway, it's a pretty tragic story. It's about a teenager in London who falls to his death from a balcony on a luxury apartment overlooking the Thames, and kind of the investigation around how this came to be. Turns out that he was 19 and he was kind of purporting to be or living kind of this fake existence as a Russian oligarch's son, even though he's not Russian and his parents were not oligarchs. And so his parents, who were grieving his death, started to kind of dig in to the circumstances around his death. And it just unraveled into this web of intrigue and you know, shady characters and whatever. And it's a sad story. It's a really interesting story. And, you know, Radden Keefe's just so good, as we both know. So that's really good. So that's my first one.
Man, that's great. I haven't read that. Happy to add it to my list. Sounds like a heavy topic, but I can't say that it's a final notes necessarily, but for those who are the Arthur C. Clarke fans in our audience, I was just recommended Rendezvous with Rama, which I'm maybe 20% into, and I cannot wait to sit down and read more of it on the plane tonight.
Oh, nice.
I'm so excited. Great story. 1973, I guess maybe a short novel. I'm not really sure. I'm reading it like on my Kindle, so I'm not really sure how big it is. But it's really, really good. I'm pumped to read it.
Oh, that's great.
And then my main one this week, this may seem like a basic one, but it's meant more and more to me the more I've used it in the last couple of weeks. We talked at the top of the show about summer being back and being out and being warm. I am prone, at least for the first part of the season, to some pretty solid sunburns. Mm-hmm. Once I get that base down, things are okay. And I really find sunscreen to be a pain, especially the stuff that's like a cream.
Yeah.
I don't really like what it does to watch straps. I often don't like what it does to clothing or to the arms of sunglasses. If they have little rubber pads, all that kind of stuff, it gets kind of gross or it can deteriorate, all that kind of thing. I switched recently. I bought it in advance of the trip I talked about last week in Utah to Blue Lizard. And some of you will know this brand. They seem to be quite popular. I've now used it for about a week. It comes in like a little, you know, looked like a miniature version of like a deodorant applicator. So it's very easy to travel with. Wow. And it goes on so cleanly and relatively dry. And it doesn't leave my hands all oily. So I'm not looking for a spare t-shirt or a towel or whatever to wipe it off.
Yeah.
I'm just super happy with it. It works really well. You know, I'm prone, the ones that bug me the most are when I burn the backs of my hands.
Mm-hmm.
I'm out on a bike all day or in the kayak or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I can find that to be quick, and it's so easy to be able to applicate just to the back of your hands, just to the bridge of your nose or the back of your neck. Highly recommend. Is it a very exciting thing to recommend? No. But it does mean that I can be outside without worrying that I'm just contributing another 10th of a percentage point to my eventual skin cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So I highly recommend the Blue Lizard stuff, and I included their website. They seem to have a ton more products than I was even aware of. I just bought this little travel one on Amazon, and I'm really impressed with it. This is not a sponsorship or an ad or anything. I bought it with my own money at whatever the street price was on Amazon.
Nice. Yeah, good. I'm always looking for new sunscreens. Yeah, it's great.
Dude, and small enough to carry with you and it can't get crushed in your bag, and then you open the bag your sunscreen's everywhere.
Oh, yeah, that's
it's just like you avoid all these little problems by just getting away from the cream.
Yeah, so, yeah. Cool.
Yeah, there you go. And how about yours? What's your second?
Yeah, I've got a quick second one. It's a bit of a self-shill here. Well, not quite, but it's a story on Worn and Wound called A Fistful of Jade, Wind Up in a Bay 2026 with Marathon and Prometheus Design Works. This is a story that Worn and Wound put up covering that dive that I took part in out in Big Sur a few weeks back with some good buddies, you know, Chris Soule and Ben Lowry and Asha Wagner and Brock Stevens and some others. And it was a story that I believe was written by our friend Kyle Snar along with Chris Soule. They put their heads together and collaborated on this story, and some great photography in here about that adventure. So, you know, if you remember that episode a few weeks ago that I talked about diving for jade out in Big Sur, you want to read a little bit more and see some really cool photos of Marathon's and Prometheus Design Works stuff and diving, check it out. So we'll put a link in the show notes.
That's great. Yeah, looking forward to it for sure. And a nice follow-up to what we had talked about on the previous episode just after that adventure.
Yeah.
All right, cool. There we go. A whole episode. Bumper repairs and watches we don't wear that much, but maybe should, and all that kind of stuff. So a pretty solid one for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And as always, thanks so much for listening. If you want to subscribe to the show notes, get into the comments for each episode, or consider supporting the show directly, and maybe even grab a new TGN-signed NATO, please visit thegraynato.com. Music throughout A Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote from Socrates, who said, "He is richest who is content with the least, for content is the wealth of nature."